For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It's December the 3rd. We are in Shmuel Beis, Perek Yud Aleph, Chapter 11. So we come tonight to the perhaps the most famous story of David HaMelech's lifetime, and the one that has come to define him in many ways. And at the same time, it's one of the most misunderstood stories, and it is the one for which David is the most maligned. Now, the Navi, in presenting the story, does a very good job of making David look very, very bad. So, we, in learning through the story, we are going to be doing a couple of things. First of all, we're going to be reading the Psukim carefully to show that there are inconsistencies where, on the one hand, David is made to look bad, but on the other hand, logically, it can't possibly be as bad as is being described. Mm-hmm. Second, we're going to explain the story to show what actually he did wrong. He definitely did something wrong. What he actually did wrong is not exactly consistent with what appears to be just reading it without any depth and without any thought. Third, we're going to have to understand how this came to happen. What's the background over here that led to this whole story, and how is it that David made an error of this magnitude? And then, of course, we're going to have to deal with what the consequences are and how that works. Now, by way of introduction to the story, we have to, first of all, remind ourselves of what we spoke about at the end of last week, which is that the story of David and Bathsheba is one which the Gemara says, as I mentioned to you, that Bathsheba was preordained for David, Misheshes and Mevreshes, from the 6 days of creation. So even though when we meet Bathsheba, she's going to be married to somebody else, that does not take away from the fact that she was destined to be David's wife. And it was going to happen one way or another. The mistake David is going to make is in the way that he orchestrates that she becomes his wife. But that she was going to become his wife was inevitable. Which then is going to beg the question, how do we see Uriah in this story? Is he somebody who we look at similar to Avigail and Naval? If you'll recall, Naval was married to Avigail, and in the end, Naval mistreats David. David is going to kill Naval. Avigail stops David, and Hashem kills Naval. So then Avigail becomes David's wife. Had David killed Naval, likely Avigail would have also become his wife, but it would not have been the correct way to do it. Avigail stopped David, and instead Hashem killed Naval, and Avigail became David's wife. Now, Avigail was not necessarily destined to David from the 6 days of creation. There we learned that had Naval lived up to who he could have been, he would have played a very important supporting role to David HaMelech, and Avigail would have been the wife of the person playing that very important supporting role to David HaMelech. Naval fell down on the job, and as a result, Avigail, who was a great tzaddikess, now was without the husband that was appropriate for her, and Hashem arranged things that Naval would be killed, and then Avigail would marry into David's family. And Avigail produces, as we've mentioned, the Kilav or Daniel, one of the four people who never did a sin. So there you have an example where David was going to take the situation into his own hands, and that would have been the wrong thing to do. In the end, the same result happens. The man is killed, not by David, but by Hashem, and David marries Avigail. Here, had David not had David not taken the role that he took, as we'll learn about, with Bathsheba and Uriah Hachiti, there is no question that Uriah would have been killed and David would have married Bathsheba. That had to happen in some manner or other. We have to understand what would have happened. Would Uriah have been killed by a plague, the same way that Nabal was killed by a plague? Would Uriah have been killed in battle, which is what actually is going to happen in the story? Because we have to understand what was going to happen. David is orchestrating something that was going to happen anyway. The mistake is going to be in the way that he orchestrates it, and perhaps even the fact that he orchestrates it is going to be the problem. But that the events themselves were destined to happen. So that's going to take some explanation. Bear in mind, as we ended last time, that whenever it comes to Malchus based David, for the line of David HaMelech, which is the most important line in the history of the world, ongoing history of the world, the threat to that line happens regularly. Every few generations there is a threat to destroying that line. And it happened more than once in history where the line was hanging on by a thread. And it was only through the acts of incredible bravery and incredible mesiras nefesh, self-sacrifice, chesed, tzidkus, all kinds of great things that prevented that line from being wiped out. We learned about it with Rus. We learned about it with Yehuda and Tamar in our Sunday night class. We learned about it with Lot and his daughters and other stories as well. In Sefer Malachim, we're going to have a story where David's line is down to one person, and that person ends up surviving. It happens with regularity. As we learned last time, David knows that something is going to happen over here. David is aware of that. And David knows that he's not yet married to the woman who is going to produce the line of Mashiach. Bathsheba is the correct woman, that he does not get wrong. He is correct that Bathsheba is the woman, and he is correct that Uriah is going to have to be killed in order for him to marry her. But as we will see, it's going to be the way that he orchestrates it, or even perhaps the fact that he orchestrates it, that's going to be a problem. Now, there are other words of introduction we have to give over here, which will not be clear now how to reconcile all of this. But you have to hear at the outset how much complexity there is in this story. The Gemara tells us that David HaMelech was not ro'i la'osamaisa. He wasn't fitting for this story, meaning it should never have happened. He shouldn't have done this. It shouldn't have happened to him. So the Gemara says, then why did it happen? And the Gemara says, in order to show people that tshuva is possible. If a person does a terrible avera and says, forget it, I'm finished, I couldn't possibly get myself out of this. So we have the story of David and Bathsheba. A person can say, well, look what David did, and he did teshuva, I can do teshuva too. Now that's a very difficult statement in Chazal. What does that mean? Are we absolving David of any culpability over here? It only happened in order to teach people about Teshuvah. It's very hard to say that. But Chazal do say something like that. So we're going to have to understand, how do we incorporate that? Was this story preordained? Was it meant to happen? We don't usually believe such things. We don't believe that people's free will is manipulated. A person has the right to make choices. And David is going to be punished for what happens over here. So that's going to need to be understood. Another thing that needs to be understood over here is that David is going to say to Hashem, the Gemara tells us, David says to Hashem, Hashem, it is goli v'yadua lefanecha, you know full well that I could have overcome my Yetzer Hara, but I didn't, in order that people shouldn't say the Talmud, the student, outdid the Rebbe. The Rebbe here is Hashem. The student is David. What does that mean? What kind of statement is that? It means like David is saying, well, I really could have overcome it. I didn't bother. So that also needs to be understood. So there's complexity here that's going to have to be explained. It's going to take us much longer than one class. I expect it to take at least three before we get through it. And unfortunately, if you miss one, you're going to have a hard time. So I encourage everyone to stay current. If you miss one, catch up online. But we're going to have to stay with this. One last word of introduction is that we've talked about this before, but this is the time we really must emphasize it. And that is that the sins of the great ones are never what they appear to be. The sins of the great ones are always much more subtle than the Navi makes it seem. This is true in the Chumash, and it's even more so in the Navi. And we know that Hashem is medaktik im chasidav kechut hasayir. Hashem holds the great ones to an extremely high standard, and even if they deviate slightly from where they should be, they are punished. Not only are they punished, but they are accused of doing terrible things. The Gemara says in Maseches Shabbos, Kol ha'omer David chata. Anybody who says David did a sin, eino ela toa, he's only making a mistake. It's not so. If you say David sinned, you are making a mistake. Now we've quoted this Gemara before regarding the sons of Eli and other people, and we've explained that Gemara doesn't mean to say David didn't do a sin. He did do a sin. But anybody who says that David sinned on the level that it appears that he sinned in the Navi is making an egregious error. A mistake. He did not do the level of sin that the Navi says. Then why does the Navi say it? And the answer is that what David did on his madrega, on his level, is akin to if we, on our much lower level, would do what the Navi says David did. So the Navi is going to accuse David of being boil and ashes ish, which is adultery. David did not commit adultery. But what he did on his level is akin to someone like us in the rank and file committing adultery, God forbid. That's what the Navi is drawing our attention to. And we are to relate to the story the same way we would relate to someone in our day and age, a regular person committing adultery. What would be the way to deal with that sin? The way David deals with his sin and the way Hashem deals with David for his sin, that's the way we should relate to the sin of adultery. But David did not commit adultery, as we will see as we move through this story. A person never sins, is never held accountable for sinning, unless they could have done better. Therefore, the only way that we can justify David being punished, which he will be punished pretty severely for this story, we have to say he could have done better. But the mistake of the great ones is never in the pure physical taiva, the pure physical weaknesses that we have. That's not where the great ones sin. The great ones sin up here. It's always in a very subtle decision. The great ones are always making very important, very subtle decisions. And they're held to a very high standard of making those decisions properly. The thing is, they're capable of consistently making perfect decisions. When they don't, why don't they? Why would they? Why would Moshe hit the rock instead of speaking to the rock? How could he make that mistake? Now again, with Moshe Rabbeinu as well, it's not that, well, Hashem said to talk to the rock, but I'll hit the rock instead. That's ridiculous. We wouldn't do that. How could we accuse Moshe Rabbeinu of doing that? It must be, it was much more subtle than that. There was many more things going on in the story, which is filled in by Rashi, and Chazal fill in the blanks, that contributed to his making the mistake inside. But even the great ones only make such a mistake if deep down there's something in the physical level, in the base level, either in physical desire or in the desire for honor or something like jealousy, something like pride. There's something there very, very, very subtle which is affecting their decision, but they don't even realize it. When David is going to send for Bathsheba, believe me, David did not experience within himself any sense of, God forbid, lust. Not at all. David looked at it as a purely intellectual decision. It was the wrong intellectual decision. But he saw himself as making the decision with pure intellect, filtered through the Torah as it should be, and did not perceive within himself any degree of subjectivity based on pure physical desires. He saw himself as an objective decision maker based on the Torah. Chazal tell us that no, there was a level of physical desire there which made him make that mistake. But I'm pointing out to you, it's so subtle that even when he made the decision, he did not realize it was happening. This is clear and obvious in the story, as we will show, that later when the Navi comes to him to tell him that he did something wrong, he has a clear conscience. David has no idea that he did anything wrong. Similar to Shaul HaMelech when he left Agag alive, and we pointed out at the time, Shaul was not did not think he did anything wrong. He thought he made the right decision. It was the wrong decision. David here also is going to believe until the Navi comes to him and have to point it out to him in an obvious manner that any one of us would have figured out in a second. The Navi has to actually spell it out for David and tell him, you're the one, you did something wrong. And David then, in his inimitable way, is able to say immediately, I sinned, chatasi. That's where David rises above everybody else. So he's immediately able to recalibrate and admit that he did something wrong. But he doesn't realize it at the time, because in his mind it was all perfectly the right decision to make. Similarly, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he hit the rock, it was an intellectual decision. Chazal tell us, though, that it was actually a decision that was affected by his becoming upset with the Jewish people. It says, Vayichar, he got upset, he got angry. And that's what did it. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu, believe me, did not perceive at the time that there was any degree of anger or annoyance within him that was affecting his decision. Not like the rest of us, that when we're angry and we're making a bad decision, we know we're angry and we're not making a bad decision and we do it anyway, as we all do. Right? I'm yelling at my kids. I know I shouldn't be yelling at my kids, but I'm so angry I yell at my kids anyway. I know it's wrong and I know I'm going to regret it later, but I can't help myself. I can't help myself. I just tell myself I can't help myself. Right? That's us. Because we're weak. But that's not the great ones. The great ones, it's a calm, dispassionate, apparently objective decision. But when deep, deep, deep down, there's something there that affects the decision. And that's what's going to be happening here with David HaMelech. So let us first give you the first insight into this whole thing. The Gemara tells us that David HaMelech said to Hashem, why is it, he saw with Nevuah, that later in history, there's going to be something called the Shmona Esrei. In their day, there was no Shmona Esrei, meaning people davened, but there wasn't a formal Shmona Esrei. The formal Shmona Esrei was arranged by the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, the men of the Great Assembly. So David HaMelech said to Hashem, why is it that Klal Yisrael is going to say Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, VeElokei Yaakov, the God of Avram, the God of Yitzchak, the God of Yaakov, but they're not going to say Elokei David, the God of David. Now, did he actually ask Hashem this question, or the Gemara is relating it in a question-answer form? But this is what was going on between David and Hashem. It's probably the second. It probably wasn't actually a dialogue, but this is the way the Gemara presents it in a story form to make us understand what happened. So Hashem responded to David. The reason is because I tested the Avos. I tested them. I didn't test you. They withstood their tests, so they deserve that they should be included in the Shema Esrei, Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. You were never tested. So David says, and it's a pasuk in Tehillim, David says, test me! Test me, please! So Hashem says to David, okay, I'll test you. Not only am I going to test you, but I'll do one better for you. I will even tell you how I'm going to test you, in what area I'm going to test you in.
and you're still going to fail. You're going to have an advantage they didn't have. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov weren't tipped off in advance how they were going to be tested. Avram didn't know that Sarah was going to be taken. Avram didn't know there was going to be a famine. Avram didn't know that he was going to have to shecht Yitzchak. He didn't know any of this. It all just happened. And he passed the tests. I'm going to tell you in advance that the test is going to involve Eshes Ish. It's going to involve adultery. It's going to involve a married woman. I'm warning you in advance where the test is going to be. And nevertheless, we'll see if you can live up to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. David HaMelech, once having known what the test was going to be, he took steps to prevent himself from failing. He took steps, which is a prudent thing to do. If you know that you're going to be tested, well, then you study for the test, right? So if you know you're going to be tested and you can give yourself all the advantages you need to pass, then you're going to give yourself the advantages you need to pass. So what did David HaMelech do? He did the following. We know the Gemara says that the Gemara tells us a story that Rav Chiya's wife, I believe it was Rav Chiya, Rav Chiya's wife was a terrible wife. Whatever he would ask her for, she would do the opposite. So his son said to him, why don't you divorce her? If she's not acting as a, you don't have a great relationship here, so divorce her. So Rav Chiya said back, Dayan, she's enough for us. She performs the basic functions of a wife. The basic functions of a wife she performs, therefore, the fact that everything else isn't good, that's not a reason for me to divorce her, because she does take care of the basic functions of wife. When you strip it all away, the basic functions, I'm not talking about growth and all kinds of, you know, wonderful spiritual conquests, I'm talking about the basic functions of wife. What's the basic functions of a wife? It's not laundry, and it's not cooking, and what's the basic function of the wife? The Gemara says, she raises the children, and she saves me from sin. She performs those two functions. The fact is, she's raising my children, and the fact is that I am saved from sin. What sin is he talking about? Obviously, he's talking about the sin of lusting after women. Not Tavas Nashon, but Tavas Nashon. Because I'm married to her, and she is permitted to me, so that allows me to control my Yetzer Hara. My evil inclination is under control because of her, and therefore I have unending gratitude to her for doing these two things for me, and therefore there's no reason for me to divorce her. The David HaMelech, recognizing that he was going to be tested in this area, did the prudent thing, which is that he had several wives, and he made sure to control his Yetzer Hara with his wives, which means he made sure to be intimate with his wives at the proper times in order to make sure that he was not in a position where he was not in control of his Yetzer Hara, so that when the test would come before him, he would be able to pass the test. So the Gemara says what he did is he increased his time with his wives. Meaning whatever amount of times he was with his wives before, he increased the times. The way the Gemara says this, and we're going to see it in the Pasuk very presently when we read the Pasuk, the way the Gemara says it is, the Gemara says that typically intimacy between a husband and wife should take place at night. Now, during the day is permissible, but it's not the optimal time. The optimal time is at night. David HaMelech, it says, he turned things over, and he was intimate with his wives even during the day. And in that manner, he felt he was always in control of his Yetzer Hara, because he always had a permissible way of expressing it, and therefore there was no way that the Yetzer Hara could grab him. And he made a terrible mistake with that method. That was his method of being prepared for the test that he knew would be before him. But he made a big mistake. And the mistake is, the Gemara says in Maseches Sukkah and other places, the Gemara says the nature of this Yetzirah, the truth is one can apply this to other types of taifa. It's not only this particular desire. One can apply it to eating. In really all physical desires, the same rule applies. But the Gemara says it about this one. The Gemara says, Masbi'o ro'ev mar'ivo saveya. One who satiates the desire is hungry. Mm-hmm. And one who starves the desire is satiated. Anybody who's ever dieted knows that when a person begins to withhold their eating, they reach a point where they cross there's a certain threshold they cross, and then they're less hungry. The more you eat, the hungrier you are. It's not the other way around. So David made this mistake. And therefore, by increasing his time with his wives, rather than controlling his Yetzirah, it actually increased his Yetzirah. Now, he didn't perceive it, but that's ultimately what is going to affect his decision-making with Bathsheba. Again, when he makes the fatal decision, it's not going to be with any sense that he's being controlled by his Yetzirah, but because he's operating on such a subtle level, even the most subtle desire is going to affect his decision, and it's going to skew it. And as a result, he's going to make a mistake. That's the starting point of this story. Now, I know there's some questions. Before I take the questions, even the story itself needs understanding. What's David talking about? He wants them. Is he jealous of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? What is happening over here? The Gemara's introduction to the story is a person should never ask to be tested. That's the way the Gemara, and then brings this story as an example where you don't ask to be tested. That's why in the morning we say in our morning brachos we say veloli de nisayon. Don't bring us to a test. If we're tested, we want to pass. But please, Hashem, we'd rather avoid the test. Don't test us. We're no better than David HaMelech. If David asked to be tested and didn't pass, what hope do we have? So we never want to ask to be tested. So David made this mistake. Why is he, what is this? Is this jealousy? So Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are called the Avos. And the Gemara says, Gimel Nikru Avos. There are three Avos, three patriarchs, no more. That's it. There's three patriarchs. There's four Imahos, four matriarchs, no more. Now, a matriarch and a patriarch does not have to mean that you are the father or mother of all of Klal Yisrael. The proof is the matriarchs. Rachel and Leah are both considered matriarchs. Neither one is the mother of every single one of us. Some of us go back to Rachel, some of us go back to Leah, depending on what tribe you're from. So even though with the fathers or the patriarchs, we all go back to Yaakov, we all go back to Yitzchak, we all go back to Avraham, except for the converts, but the converts anyway are considered to be Avraham's children. So we all go back to all of them. But in theory, there could have been another Av. There could have been another father who would be called an Av, even though he's not the father of everybody. David is asking, why aren't I included? If I am the one who is creating this line of Mashiach, shouldn't I also be part of that list of Avos? He wasn't asking out of jealousy. He wasn't saying it's not fair. He was saying, doesn't it make sense? What he was asking honestly, what's the difference? Why is it that I wouldn't be included? And Hashem responded, the answer is because they were tested and you weren't. Then David asked to be tested. Says, so test me, because I'm sure I can succeed. David was right. He could have withstood any test. He could have. David, the Gemara says, that the Pasuk says in Tehillim, Libi cholol bekirbi, my heart is dead inside of me. The heart means the desires, like it says in Shema, Lo sasuru achare levavchem, don't follow your heart. David HaMelech's heart was dead. He completely subjugated his desires. He had complete and total control. He could have passed any test Hashem threw at him. But when Hashem, when he asked for the test, then Hashem stacked it against him. Then he couldn't pass. That's what the Gemara means, that David says to Hashem, you know I could have passed any test. I could have controlled my Yetzer Hara. But why not? So that the people wouldn't say that Talmud, the student, he outdid the Rebbe. Because David asked, which was the wrong thing to do, therefore was stacked against him. This doesn't absolve David. He made a mistake. The mistake was that he asked for the test, and that led to another mistake, in that he prepared for it in the wrong way, which leads to another mistake in the way that he will take Bathsheba and the whole story. It's going to be one mistake leading to another. But the root mistake is that he asks for the test. Okay. Now we're going to read the parak. I'll take a couple of questions, but we haven't even read any psukim yet. We're going to read the entire parak. As I said before, the parak, the chapter, is written in a way that makes David look really bad. There's going to be many things in the story which are going to be profoundly disturbing. And we're going to go through it now, at least with this background. And again, over the next several classes, we're going to try to work out what we can. Keep in mind that after all is said and done, David is still held in the highest esteem by Hashem and by everybody else. The Gemara tells us that in David HaMelech's time, after he did this, the other people in his day, people of stature, held, in their minds, David was diminished. They said, David's not so great. And they dismissed David. And it wasn't until the time of Shlomo HaMelech, when he built the Beis HaMikdash, and he wanted to inaugurate it, and the doors closed and would not open. And Shlomo HaMelech said, Chaf Dal Renanos, he said 24 different types of praises of Hashem, and it wouldn't open. And he said another kapitel, wouldn't open. And then finally he said, remember David, my father, your trusted servant, and the gates swung open. And when that happened, the Gemara says, all of David's enemies, their faces turned colors, and in shame, because they realized they were wrong about David. We have to be careful not to make the same mistake. In David's time, they made the mistake. They started to believe that David wasn't as great as he really was. But he was. He was. And no matter what we're going to read over here, and no matter how bad it sounds, you got to keep in mind, we're talking about David HaMelech. We're not talking about any one of us. And although it's true he did something wrong, our opinion of David has to still remain as great as it always was, because it doesn't change. David is still the great David HaMelech. He's still the producer of Mashiach. And he's still the epitome of the Eved of Hashem, as he always has been. Okay, questions? Yeah.
He's so close to Hashem, and you mentioned in one of your sentences that he had Nebuah. So he knew this was going to be God's will, obviously, right? But he just chose the wrong way to get to it, right?
The marrying Bathsheba?
Yeah.
Yes.
But he saw that all along.
Well, he didn't know he was making the wrong decision when he made the wrong decision. He thought he made the right decision. We'll have to read that through. You'll see. He thought he made the right decision.
I guess what concerns me is why the testing is very confusing. Why was the whole scenario necessary? Testing.
He asked for it. You want to know why Hashem didn't test him on his own? That's a good question. Why didn't Hashem?
He's been tested all along.
Yeah, that's a good question. Why? Good.
One big challenge.
That's true. Okay, you're asking, how can we say Hashem didn't test David? There are many tests we think that he went through, number one. And number two, you're asking, if in fact he wasn't tested, why didn't Hashem test him? Why did it take David asking for the test? Why didn't Hashem just...
Why this instance?
Okay, good. That's a good question. That's a good question. Good question?
Well, my question is, you gave the two things that a wife is supposed to do for a husband?
No, the most basic function.
Okay, so what's the most basic function for a man, for a woman? Is it in the ketubah?
For sure, that's at least that. At least that. I don't remember a Gemara that says it as clearly as this. I mean, there's no question support is a basic function of a husband to a wife. There's no question. But the Torah really spells it out. The Torah says, Sherek Susavel Nasa. Gemara says he has to provide her with food, clothing, and intimacy. So, food, shelter, and intimacy. So that the Torah spells out. The Torah doesn't spell out the other way around. Yeah.
is this to be taken? In other words, he did actually ask for the test. Is it like a?
So it's. So that's what I'm saying.
Is it explaining it or it's real?
Right. So I doubt there was actually a dialogue like this between David and Hashem. Most likely, it was David saying, "Hashem, test me. Why aren't you testing me?" And Hashem even let him know through Nevor, whatever it is, that how he was going to be tested.
Was tested his whole life.
Okay, that's a good question.
Yeah. His brother's treating him differently than father and all that.
I mean, he's had a rough life.
He doesn't feel like he's been tested.
Right.
Right after
so, we could learn from that,
that's true too. That's true too.
He lost his connection.
What's that?
He lost a connection to Hashem somehow that he felt that this testing.
I don't know. Part of the punishment is going to be that he's going to go through 6 months of being separated from Hashem. Which, as you can imagine, for David HaMelech, that would be profoundly painful.
Sure,
yeah, he's going to go through 6 months of Taras, where he will be, he'll be disconnected from Hashem.
At which point then would it have said that he maybe lost some kind of closeness to Hashem?
At this point, not yet. It doesn't say yet. I mean, it's going to be through this. Sin is what separates us from Hashem. That is it. Only sin. Yeah.
I know. I thought I heard somewhere that because of his sin with Bathsheba that. Is he departed from him for 22 years?
No, 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Six months. That's what the Gemara said. 6 months. The Shekhinah, and the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin also separated them. He got Saras. He was quarantined. 6 months.
Maybe part of the reason why David's travails were not considered tests is because they were not specifically challenges to his nature, whereas Abraham was challenged in the area of Hesed.
That's true.
And Yaakov was challenged in the area of Emes. I don't know what Yitzhak exactly was challenged in, but it's really a test if you have to do something profoundly against your nature. And we don't really see that, even though David did a lot of brave things and wonderful things. They were apparently consistent with his own nature.
Okay, so you're suggesting this one is going to be against his nature.
I'm saying that perhaps what Hashem means by a test, a real test, is something that drives a person to act against their own nature in a very deep way.
It could be.
Even though David had done a lot of things and been through a lot of things, you know, there's nothing we can point to that says, here's a brave man forced to act like a coward or whatever.
Yeah, right. Okay, could be. Could be right. Okay, let's read through the Pesukim. It's Perkei Av, chapter 11. Vayhi lishuvas hashana was at the turn of the year, meaning that the events of the previous parak, the previous chapter, were now approximately a year later. Ammon is still holed up in their cities, and all the other nations are subjugated to David, and now the year is turning. Le'es seis hamelachim, at the time that the kings go out, because it's good weather. Vayishlach David es Yoav v'esavadav imo. David sends Yoav and his servants v'es kol Yisrael and all the Jews, meaning the army. Vayashchisu es b'nei Ammon. Now they're finishing up the job with Ammon. They destroyed the people of Ammon, and Ammon had one major city. The name of that city was Rabbah. Vayatsuru al Rabbah, and they besieged the city of Rabbah. The David Yoshev Yerushalayim, David is sitting in Yerushalayim. So now he sends out Yoav to finish the job. Last we saw Ammon, they turned tail and ran away from the Jews. Now they're being taken to task, and David is sends Yoav to go finish off the job. They destroy Ammon, and the last vestige of Ammon's strength is in the city of Rabbah, which is critical for the story coming up. Note the phrase Lishuvas Hashana at the turn of the year. There is no question in my mind that this dovetails with what our sages tell us, that this is a perek of Teshuva. That David HaMelech is here to teach us Teshuva, as Chazal tell us. David is going to make a mistake, but it's going to be a mistake which will ultimately teach us about Teshuva. Verse 2. Vahile Sa'er, it was towards evening. Vayakam David me'al mishkavo. David got up from upon his bed. This is where our sages learn from here that he overturned his bed, meaning that the intimacy which is associated with a bed, he overturned the way it was normally done. and he was involved with it during the day as well. Vayisalech haGag, but the literal meaning is that he got up in the middle of the night or at night. Vayisalech haGag beis haMelech, he went on the roof of the palace. Vayar isha rochetzes me'al haGag, he saw a woman bathing on top of the roof. Vayisha tovas me'ra ma'od, the woman was very beautiful. The Gemara says that Bathsheba was washing her hair underneath a canopy, and she was completely covered. Bathsheba was at Sanua. She was a modest woman. She was completely covered under this canopy, wherever it was. And the Satan caused a bird to fly. It must have been a big bird, a bird of that you would hunt. David saw the bird at night. David was on the roof and he saw the bird, and he shot an arrow at the bird. And when he shot the arrow at the arrow struck the canopy and knocked the canopy over, exposing Bathsheba. So it was a series of events that neither Bathsheba nor David was planning. But at the end, what happened is that Bathsheba was momentarily exposed to David. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, Vayishlach David, Vayidrosh la'isha. David sent to check out the woman. Who is this woman? What about her? Vayomer, and he said, meaning the messenger said, Halozos Bathsheba bas Eliam. Behold, this is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam. Eshes Uriah Hachiti, the wife of Uriah Hachiti. Now right away, the phrase halozos should tip you off. Well, isn't this? Is that the way? If she was a total stranger, unheard of, then the messenger would come back and say the woman is Bathsheba, bas Eliam, the wife of Uriah Hachiti. The phrase isn't this, or this, you know who this is? It sounds like she was a known entity. David knew of her, didn't recognize her, may have never seen her in his life, but he was aware that there was somebody called Bathsheba. Now, just so you know who she is, Bathsheba Bas Eliam, the daughter of Eliam. Eliam has a very illustrious father. Unfortunately, he becomes infamous. And her father's name is Achitophel. Achitophel is going to be the advisor of David, who the Navi is going to say, asking Achitophel for advice would be like asking Hashem directly. That's how informed Achitophel was. Eventually, Achitophel is going to lose his portion in the world to come. He's going to lose his chelek in Olam Haba with the rebellion of Avshalom, which will be a result of this story. The rebellion of Avshalom will be a result of what happens here with Bathsheba. But Bathsheba is his granddaughter, the wife of Uriah Hachiti. So David knows right away that she's a married woman, and he knows who she is.
Why is she married to
Hachiti? Well, why is he called Hachiti?
Ah, he's Jewish, but he's called
Hachiti. Yes. Yeah, he's definitely Jewish. Question is he a convert? Is it because of where he was from? Okay. Vayishlach David Malachim, David sent messengers, Vayikachah, and he took her. Vatavoi love, she came to him, Vayishkav Ima, and he was intimate with her. Vihim iskadesh es mitum asa, but don't think that she was a nida. Don't think that she was menstrually impure. Rather, she was purified from her tumah. She had gone to the mikvah prior to this event. Vatashav el beisah, then she returned to her home. So this is obviously incredibly perplexing. He goes and he sends for her and is intimate with her. So what is that all about? And the Navi tells us, by the way, don't worry, she was pure.
She wasn't Anita.
She wasn't Anita. But she's a married woman. So you see the inconsistency. Obviously, if David did the sin of adultery, the Navi telling us that she was pure is laughable. It's a bad joke. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Navi is coming to tell us not only was she permitted to David, but she was even not Anita. The Navi is trying to explain to us she was permitted. That's the Navi's goal over here, is to explain that she was permitted. But that leaves us perplexed. How was she permitted?
What's the time frame here?
Meaning?
He sees her at night. And then what point does he sense for her?
It must have been soon. I mean, it's the next day, I assume, that he checks her out. I don't know if it was the next night that she came to him. I don't know. So...
What's that mean, yeah?
So I don't...
Yeah.
So I don't know if it was the next night, but it doesn't tell us. So... It must have been quick.
Is a married woman allowed to say no to a Jewish king?
If it's an Avera, yes, absolutely. Not allowed to. She must say no. If it's an Avera, she has to say no.
Why isn't she not?
Right, okay. Now, first question you have to ask yourself is, before we get to the Eishes Ish, to the adultery part of it, the married woman part of it, this business of being not a Nida. So, we know that women do not go to the mikvah unless their husbands are around. Her husband was at war. He was one of the ones with Yoav out at the battlefield. So why would she have gone to the mikvah?
Mm-hmm.
So that is only a question that we would ask, because we're living in the year 5775 and we therefore are not thinking properly. But if you're living in the time of David HaMelech, then you are dealing with all kinds of things that have to remain tar if possible. We have karbonos, we have truma, you have all kinds of things that require purity. Therefore, it was much easier for a woman who was not a Nida to deal with those things than a woman who was a Nida. And therefore, everybody went to the mikvah whenever they could. Men and women, whenever they would become Tamei, as soon as they were able to become Tar, they would. Because it made life easier. And your entire way of dealing with people and dealing with food items, all kinds of things, was much simpler, much more convenient if you were purified. So it is not a question why she would have gone to the mikvah. In those days, anytime a woman was able to, whether she was with her husband or not, whether she was married or not, she would go to the mikvah as soon as she was able to. So the Navi is telling us, we should know, she was in that state. She had gone to the mikvah. Now what about the Eishes Ish part? We really know the answer to this question. We learned about it when we did the story of Goliath. At that time, David's father, Yishai, sends David to the battlefield, and he sends him to his brothers, his three brothers who are there, and he tells them, take arubasam, take something from them. Take something from them. So what was he to take from them? The Gemara explains that all of the soldiers of David HaMelech, now that was Shaul HaMelech, but all the soldiers of David HaMelech would give a get. They would give a divorce document to their wives before they went to battle. Because in the event that something would happen at battle, and they would die, and they would be buried in an unidentified grave, or they would become POWs, or missing in action, then the wives should not remain agunos. They shouldn't remain unable to remarry. Therefore, every soldier issued a get prior to going to war. Now, one can ask, what about a Kohen? Because a Kohen who divorces his wife can't take her back. So that needs explanation. But they would give a get to their wives. Therefore, every woman whose husband was at war was no longer a married woman. Now, there is a debate amongst the Mefarshim what the nature of this get was. Tosfos understands that the get was a straight-out divorce. They divorced their wives. When they came back from war, then they remarried. A kohen wouldn't be able to do that, but everybody else did. Rashi understands it was a divorce al tanai, on condition. If I don't return, then this divorce document should take effect. If I do return, then it should be null and void. So it was on condition, according to Rashi. Either way, if he didn't come back, and at the end Uriah is not going to come back, he's going to come back temporarily, but he's going to go back to war, he's going to get killed at war, at the end of the day, either way, Bathsheba was not technically married to Uriah when David lived with her. David knew this, and he lived with her. Nevertheless, since the purpose of the get was only to protect her in case her husband doesn't come back, and it was considered to be inappropriate for a woman to go to another man while her husband was away, that would have been wrong to do. Therefore, it would be akin to taking a married woman, because emotionally they weren't divorced. It was a pragmatic thing, just in case. But they were emotionally still attached to each other. It would have been wrong for someone to live with her. But David took her. Okay. Did David marry her? David did not marry her. David just lived with her. Later he'll marry her, but he hasn't married her yet.
The get is, in case the husband doesn't come back, is there a prescribed amount of time?
There must have been. There must have been. You're saying, what if he's MIA? So then what?
Yeah,
what?
You don't know.
Yeah, there must have been a prescribed. You know, they would try to figure out. But this way, at the end of the day, she would not be stuck. Pasuk Hey, verse 5. Batahra Isha. The woman became pregnant. Batishlach batageb to David. She sent and she told David. Batomer, and she said, Hara anochi, I am pregnant. Meaning, okay, what do you want me to do now? Vayishlach David el Yoav. David sent to Yoav, the general. Shlach elai es Uriah hachiti. Send me Uriah hachiti. I want you to send home to me. Send back one soldier, Uriah hachiti. Vayishlach Yoav es Uriah el David. Yoav sent Uriah to David. Vayavo Uriah elav. Uriah came to him. Vayishal David l'shlom Yoav v'lishlom ha'am. David asked him, how's Yoav doing? How's the nation doing? V'lishlom ha'melchama. How's it going in the war? So David made a little bit of small talk with him. Vayomer David l'Uriah. David said to Uriah, Rei b'veischa, go down to your house. Urechatz raglecha, and wash your feet. That was a
euphemism.
Well, not a euphemism. It was a clean way of saying be intimate with your wife. Vayetzi Uriah mibeis hamelech. Uriah left the house of the king. And a present from the king followed him, meaning the king sent home with him food portions, so that it would be he would have what to bring his wife. He would have a time with his wife that was special. Vayishkav Uriah Pesach Beis HaMelech. Uriah slept at the doorway of the palace. Eitz Chalav Be'Adonav, along with the servants of his master. V'lo Yarad Al Beis, so he did not go down to his house. Now you have to understand that, forget what David is doing over here, which appears like David is trying to cover up what he did, because what's he trying to do? He's sending Uriah back to his wife. Uriah will be intimate, then it will be discovered that she's pregnant, and the presumption will be that the child comes from Uriah, and no one will think that she lives with David. But leave that aside for the moment. David gave Uriah direct order. David did not say to him, you have permission to take a furlough and go home. That's not what David said. David said, go to your home and do this. And Uriah directly disobeyed the king. Now, so again, when you're reading this story, it's so unthinkable what David is doing. It's very hard to think of Uriah. But when you put yourself in Uriah's shoes, Uriah is doing a terrible sin. Straight, flat-out insubordination against the king, which is Moriv Malchus, which is treason. Pasuk Yud, verse 10.
But is that just because he went with his servants in front of the king?
No, he didn't go home.
Right.
He didn't go.
That's
he was told to go home.
I mean, is that serious?
It's Moriv Malchus. He did not. He disobeyed a direct order from the king. The king didn't tell him, if you want. The king said, go home. He didn't go. Vayagidu leDavid lemer, they told David, saying, Lo yarad Uriah el beis. Uriah didn't go home. Vayomer David el Uriah. David said to Uriah, Halo miderech atabo. You've come from the way, from the road. You've been away for so long. Madu lo yarad el beisecha. Why didn't you go home? Vayomer Uriah el David. Uriah said to David, Haaron v'Yisrael v'Yehuda yoshim basukos. The Aron, the ark that they took to war, and the Jews and Yehuda, which was the main tribe, they're sitting in Sukkos, which was where they were for the war. Va'adoni Yoav, and my master Yoav, Va'av de Adoni, and the master, and the servants of my master. Who's my master the second time? David. My master Yoav, and the servants of my master, meaning you, David, al pnei asader, on the field. Chonim, they're encamped. I'm going to go home and eat and drink and be intimate with my wife. I swear by your life and the life of your soul, I'll do such a thing. How could I do that? How could I go and have a good time when they're all in it at war? Now here, it sounds sensible. It does sound sensible, but the way he says it is an incredible chutzpah. Again, it's very hard to see it because we're not in his shoes. We don't have a king. You don't say to the king, "My master Yoav."
Well, that's yeah.
My master Yoav. You're talking to the king. Mm-hmm. You say your servant Yoav. Yes. That's what you say. You don't say my master Yoav. You know, when you're talking to this happens sometimes. I've had this many times. You're talking to a Rosh Yeshiva. You're talking to one of the great Gedolim of the generation. And you want to say that your Rebbe told you to do something. It's disrespectful to say my Rebbe said.
Yeah.
My Rebbe said. He's everybody's Rebbe. My Rebbe. That's absolutely disrespectful. You can't say that. This was a very disrespectful thing to say. Uriah was no dummy. He knew what he was saying. This was Uriah deliberately slapping David in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And saying to him, "How can you tell me to do such a thing? Yoav is my master. And Yoav is in the field." This was a Uriah's way of dismissing David. Vayomer David al Uriah, David said to Uriah, "Shev bazeh gam hayom u'machar ashalcheka. Stay here today and tomorrow I'll send you away." Vayeshev Uriah v'Yerushalayim b'yom ahu u'mimacharas. He stayed in Yerushalayim that day and the next day. And he still didn't go home. David was still waiting. Maybe he'll change his mind. For all of Uriah's chutzpah, he was waiting. Maybe he would change his mind. Vayikralo David. David called him. Vayokal lefano b'yeit before him. Vayesht. And he drank. Vayishakrei. We got him drunk. Maybe he'll go home now. Vayetzei v'erev. He went out that evening. Lishkav v'mishkavo im avdei Adonav, to sleep in his bed with the servants of his master. Velveso liyarad. He did not go back to his house. Vayhi b'boker. It was in the morning. Now David knew that it was done. Nothing was going to happen. He was going to have to now deal with Uriah differently. Vayichta David Sefer al Yoav. David sent David wrote a message to Yoav, a parchment to Yoav. Vayishtach biyad Uriah, and he sent it in the hands of Uriah. Vayichtov vasefer. He wrote in this sefer, in this scroll, Lamar saying, "Havu es Uriah el mul pnei amolchama hachazaka." Put Uriah in the front lines, where the war is very strong, and then leave him there, let him be struck and let him be killed. So David is going to have Uriah deliberately thrown under the bus. He's going to have him taken to the front lines and then left there to be killed.
So Uriah knows what's going on at home there?
No, Uriah does not know what's going on at home.
It wasn't gossip.
No, nobody knew. Nobody knew. Nobody knew.
Goes to the king's
aunt
in the open?
Nobody knew. No, it was done very, very quietly. We'll see. We'll see about that.
Wait, but if she's pregnant, aren't people going to...
She knew she was pregnant. She wasn't showing it. This is right away. This is all right away. This is not...
How right away?
The Gemara says...
She's pregnant. A mom, right.
So the Gemara says she knew immediately.
She knew the next day.
She knew quickly. Right away. She knew very quickly.
And her servant?
Many women can know right away. Mm-hmm. Some women it takes till they miss a cycle, but many women know right away. Now we're over time. If anybody needs to leave, I really can't. But I think we need to finish the story. Vayhi bishmar Yoav el ha'ir. It was when Yoav was guarding the city. Vayitein es Uriah el hamakom asher yada ki anshei chayal sham. He put Uriah in the place where he knew there were soldiers there, which means he put him in a very dangerous place. The people of the city came out to fight with Yoav, as periodically happened. To break the siege, they sent out some soldiers. And some of the servants of David were killed. Uriah was also killed amongst those soldiers. Vayishlach Yoav vayagid leDavid et kol divrei hamelacha. Yoav sent to David all of the words of the war. Okay, I think it's not fair. We're gonna have to stop, but we'll continue it afterwards. We'll continue it next week.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
you. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.